Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today's show is a little bit different from our norm. Today, I'm recording on the campus of Bryant University, which hosted a terrific conference this weekend on the subject of genocide in world history. The conference was held as the annual meeting of the Northeast Region of the World History Association and attracted scholars from a variety of states and several different countries. I thought it represented an opportunity to get a good feel for the kind of subjects and interests that are at the forefront in the field today. With me today to talk about their research and about the conference are four very different scholars in the field. They run the gamut both in terms of age and experience and in terms of topics. I'm lucky to have them with me today. And in order of appearance, they're Jonathan Bush, lawyer and historian, who also teaches classes at Columbia Law School. John Cox, historian at UNC Charlotte. Tommy O'Connell, an independent scholar, formerly of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. And Michael Bryant, a professor of history at Bryant University and longtime listeners to the show may recognize his name. He was generous enough to give us time for an interview several months ago. And so what we'll do is we'll start out asking each of them to briefly describe the paper they presented today and how it fits into their broader research interests. And then we'll move on from that to talk a little bit about their broader impressions of the conference and of the field. So that's our direction. And I want to start out by saying thanks to all of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And so, Jonathan, you presented a paper today titled Lemkin and Nuremberg, How Prosecutors and Judges in the First International Trials Use Lemkin's Proposals. So I'd like to ask you just to start out by saying a little bit about your paper and what you wanted to do with it.
I was trying to look at the law of genocide from the time it was really coined by its inventor, Raphael Lemkin, in a 1944 book, and the Genocide Convention at the end of 1948, which goes in a very different direction with a definition that's problematic in many ways. And I tried to look at a number of cases where the normal view is that he advised at the first Nuremberg trial, felt it went wrong in using his concept, went home and lobbied the UN. And I tried to look at other cases, a few from Poland, but many more from the second round of Nuremberg trials that the Americans led, 12 trials from 1946 to 49, and look at how the judges and prosecutors in those cases used genocide differently from what was adopted a few years later, and how there were alternatives, like theories of crimes against humanity.
So can you say a little bit more about the alternatives?
The alternatives would have emphasized more. They actually look very similar. What they're not burdened with is this intent requirement of proving not just that a political mass atrocity, a horrible thing happened, but that the perpetrators had a particular aim of destroying a group. Because there are lots of cases where it was just an orgy of killing, where by perpetrators who don't have that intent, or where it can't be proven. Some of the best lawyers of the day, including the French chief judge at the Nuremberg trial himself, had led a movement in 1947 to push this other theory instead. And oddly enough, however it is in the race for public attention, the genocide theory was adopted. I have no problem with that, but when it got adopted, it came in a particular idiosyncratic way that many people find difficult today.
So how does this fit into your broader research interests?
Well, that's an easy one. My own research is a long-running project. I have lots of outtakes, I guess, that I publish from it, but it's a biography of Telford Taylor, the chief American prosecutor at those 12 later Nuremberg trials, and pretty much anything that his office, the Nuremberg prosecutors, were working on is grist for my mill, as is his later career, which was this important civil liberties lawyer and scholar.
And so as you look back, how has the thinking you've done in putting to this paper, has it changed this broader perspective? How has it informed this broader work?
Well, it doesn't really change what I think of Lemkin. I mean, I guess I view Lemkin now as more of a competing advocate in the realm of kind of human rights, early human rights discourse. But it underscored for me how lively, I mean, Taylor's staff at Nuremberg was well over 200 lawyers and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of research assistants and interrogators. And it's really like and by contrast to today, the many federal agencies, there were branches of the Justice Department that were smaller than that. Hmm. And so here is this a very large legal effort going on in Germany by Americans led by Taylor, and they're constantly debating and they're trying different things. And so I really kind of see this ideas in ferment on their side. Some of them gain traction with the court, some don't.
Interesting. Well, let's turn to John Cox. And your paper talked about resistance to genocide toward a comparative understanding. And you also started out your paper talking a little bit about definitions. And I wonder if you could say something. If your paper's about resistance, how do you think about resistance and try and wrestle with this definition?
Sure, yeah. Because actually in my paper, which tried to do a little too much, I tried to take on the whole question of, that John was just talking about defining genocide and so on, and then also with defining resistance, which are also the main two things that have kind of been in my teaching and research career in recent years. I started with some strong thoughts about the definitions of genocide, because I have a book coming out in a couple months that devoted a large part of the introduction to that. And then I dealt with how to define resistance, because as with genocide, how we define it has a lot to do with what we see and what comes into our field of vision and so on. And so I define resistance, I don't have a nice little quotation right in front of me, but as with genocide definitions, I believe in being a bit flexible. And in at any rate, in the early years of Holocaust and genocide research in the 60s and 70s and 80s, there was too much of a rigid, static definition of resistance that defined it, especially in Holocaust studies, simply as armed resistance by people who may have had the power to overthrow Hitler. And that tends to narrow you all the way down to the folks who conspired to bump off Adolf Hitler and carried out that attempt on July 20th, 1944. Also, those definitions were very much hostage to Cold War politics and so on. And so on the west side of the so-called Iron Curtain, politicians and universities and so on, and book publishers just wanted to look at the few number of conservative resistors they could find, and they would overlook the much more numerous forms of communist or left-wing resistance. And then in the Soviet Union and Eastern Germany and elsewhere, they only looked at communist resistance to the exclusion of everything else. But anyway, so we have to start by just looking much more broadly. So I've been, it's all sorts of efforts individually or collectively to undermine the power of the oppressor count as resistance. I've learned from people like James C. Scott, an anthropologist who studied forms of resistance, you know, by peasants in slave societies and so on. Other people who've looked, I'm just as interested really in African-American history as I am in Nazi Germany, which is my main dissertation field. And I see in there a lot of examples, too, of things that I would term self-assertion, nonconformity, dissidence, resilience, refusal to submit. All these things are part of how humans find ways to maintain a culture and maintain values like solidarity and so on that are under siege and under attack. And then also that definitely applies in looking at Nazi Germany and Nazi occupied Europe. We can see ways in which Jewish people and other targeted peoples maintain cultural practices that are under siege, help people who are maybe collected money for political prisoners, had underground prayer circles and libraries and the ghettos and so on, as well as participating in armed resistance. Because actually Jewish folks participated much more widely than is known in armed resistance, either their own groups or other groups.
And you talked about Germany and Spain in your paper.
Right.
I know that anytime you create a conference paper, you carve out a huge amount of thinking and knowledge into 15 minutes. And now I'm going to ask you to carve out from that 15 minutes just a minute and a half. But
yeah,
how do you compare those the examples of resistance in those two places?
Yeah, well, I'll say, first of all, that I can't summarize that in a minute and a half.
Fair enough.
You'll have to read all my forthcoming over the next 50 years. But in that case, I tried to slim it down a little bit by looking at the left-wing resistance. Yeah. And also as part of definitions that Jonathan and most people, I think, would agree with me that the 1948 UN definition should have included political groups as groups that could conceivably be targeted and so on. But anyway, of course, Hitler and the Franco regime, both in its war and then after coming to power in early 1939, Franco, like Hitler, targeted communist didn't make much of a distinction between all the different types of people on the left and groups on the left. The fact is that in both those countries, the Stalinist, that is, I would say, the Moscow-directed, Moscow-oriented official communist parties had done much to weaken the left in both those countries before the far-right group dictatorships took power. So I'm looking at left-wing forms of resistance and looking into the complexities also of Stalinism versus other forms of, the other types of left-wing groups and individuals.
You made an one last question for you real quick. And you made an interesting point about how historians have understudied resistance. And I'm wondering if you could speculate a little bit about why that is.
That's a good question. And you'll have to read the introduction to my forthcoming book in 12 years, because I'd really like to write a book. It is really a void. There's a book that was edited by Jacques Simelin and a couple others, four years ago called Resisting Genocide, which is more about rescue. But that didn't do a lot. Anyway, other people here might have a better answer. I might say it's just because of the fact that our field's been around for about 30 years.
Yeah.
It's always expanding. Mm-hmm. It's now recently taking in the relationship to colonialism and imperialism, and it's just something that hasn't been done very well yet. It took Holocaust studies 20 or 30 years to get around to.
Maybe we shouldn't blame ourselves. Maybe we shouldn't blame historians as much. It occurs to me as you're talking that lots of people, historians, were writing about nonviolent forms of resistance. Mm-hmm. Even in the 60s, Eric Hobsbawm's things about, early trade unionists taking home scraps from the floor and figuring that's mine, E.P. Thompson, those things. Certainly a lot of, Genovese's early work about African American and Holocaust scholars were, often not progressive, but kind of conservative, those looking at religion in the camps and so on, always talk about resistance. I think it's more the audience that people, if you have this kind of subtle notion of resistance, people think, okay, but fine, what about a gun? Weren't there people like, why weren't they fighting more? And they don't want to hear about quietly having a prayer service or taking home things that, the shop owner isn't watching carefully enough and thinking it's yours.
Right.
I think it's the audience.
How do you study that kind of resistance? That strikes me as a far more difficult thing to study than an armed rebellion or...
It is. There are sources. Actually, my first book was about these types of resistance inside in Berlin. There are sources, police records and other things, memoirs from survivors and other things. But yeah, what I would like to see either me or somebody do is something. We've now have books and studies in which we place genocides in relation to one another and try to look at similarities and dissimilarities. So I'd like to see something. And yeah, Jonathan's quite right. People have looked at this in Nazi Germany and in enslaved America and elsewhere. But I'd like to see something where we look at the forms of resistance in Indonesia, in Guatemala, in East Timor, in Iraqi Kurdistan, and during the Armenian genocide. And somehow find some semi-coherent way of seeing some patterns and so on.
Well, Tommy, let's turn to you. And you presented a paper called Revealing Secrets, Satellite Imagery and Mass Graves. Can you talk to us a little bit about your paper and what you concluded?
Okay. Well, obviously it was about satellite imagery and mass graves. I was looking at the tools that you can use as a human rights investigator, and one of the things is satellite imagery. And how it's archived and how it kind of gives you access to places that you normally wouldn't be able to go, like if it's in an active war zone or if it's in a military or government-controlled area like North Korea that you can't get in and investigate prison camps. And just using that to create visual evidence and create kind of like a timeline of events. Mm-hmm. And then the paper looked at three events, Srebrenica, Kaduli in Sudan, where there was an attack on a town and they... killed, I think, about 100 people and then brought them south of the town and created mass graves there. And then Kunduz in Afghanistan, where they were transporting prisoners after the siege in 2001 in a shipping container. And they sealed the container and everyone suffocated there and they buried. It ranged from a couple hundred to a couple thousand people in a desert in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And just kind of looked at the satellite imagery from before and after to see if there's ways to identify what was happening there. Like in Kunduz, you could tell that there was an excavator and a dump truck in the act of digging up the mass graves, and they were removing some of the bodies to kind of hide the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
and just kind of mostly just to give it an overview of the tool that human rights investigators could use when you don't have that access to the areas like in more recent human rights violations.
So help me understand, whose satellites get used? Are these military satellites or are these commercial satellites?
Recently, it's the commercial satellites.
Okay.
Like Digital Globe is a big corporation. They also have a foundation that they give image grants to researchers. I was able to get some imagery, and you could go in and look before and after it. It's some huts in Sudan. There's other organizations like Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International where they can purchase the satellite imagery. And there's also probably cooperation between the State Department and other organizations. In the U.S. and in Europe, they have a satellite as well, just working with different human rights organizations.
And so this imagery then gets used by human rights organization as both proof of crimes, but also in terms of trying to mobilize public opinion?
Yeah, it's corroborating eyewitness testimony for a lot of the issues that have happened. And then things like the Satellite Sentinel Project, they were looking at Sudan, South Sudan, when they were fighting, and trying to track, the different forces by satellite imagery and finding where there was mobilization, finding out where there were mass graves, and kind of publicize that as well to see if there's any kind of mobilization by the international community.
So one of the things that one of the broader themes that has come through in this conference and is a matter of definition, and I'm going to open this up to anybody who wants to respond, but is this question of definition, and one thing I've heard several times today is this questioning of intent. And one of the things that strikes me about satellites is that what you see is the before and after, but there's really, or let me ask, how hard is it? Is it possible to perceive or infer intent from this kind of photographic evidence?
I would say no. I mean, it's satellite imagery. It's also an interpretation by analysts. Mm-hmm. It's not the definitive thing that this is definitely a dump truck. This is definitely mass graves. Yeah. This could be, they could be moving really anything and burying it somewhere. It's kind of like a way to help corroborate eyewitness testimony and kind of bring all the pieces together. It should just be another evidentiary, trail that you could have when you're making a case towards like a criminal trial or just the international public.
Mm-hmm. May I ask a naive question?
Yeah.
Just technologically, is satellite imagery kept from the past so we can go back and say, let's see, 3 months ago over Darfur on that day?
It is. That's when I did my graduate thesis, I was looking at imagery from 2000 and then 2007 from before and after some of the attacks in the village. There's less refined imagery, like medium resolution imagery, that's kind of higher up and it's blurrier. So you can pick out cities, you can't pick out old, towns or buildings or anything like that. But that goes back to the 70s. And then you've got the military declassified imagery that probably goes like even further than that. So depending on what you look at, you can kind of make a step-by-step analysis on what's happened.
Interesting. Well, I want to bring Mike Bryan into this conversation. And Mike didn't present a paper per se, but was part of a plenary session. And the conference and the session was about genocide in world history. And I asked one of the people who were attending the panel a little bit to kind of talk to me a little bit before this about what the difference is between world history and being a historian of the world. She gave me a very thoughtful, interesting answer. And some of your comments talked about what it would mean to look at genocide from a world historical perspective. So can you maybe kind of summarize some of those? What does it mean to do genocide studies as a world historian?
Well, the original idea behind our symposium was to try to bring the discipline of world history into conjunction with the study of genocide. And I made my bones in my first book, really my first couple of books, looking at micro events, specific bounded territorial happenings involving the mass slaughter of Jews in connection with Operation Reinhardt. This is a monograph that really did not implicate the methodologies of world history, which are much more comparative, much more interested in not focusing upon a single region or a single isolated state, but instead looking at the interaction of multiple states, multiple nationalities, in generating outcomes that are trans-regional and even, in some cases, global or international. I think that this has very important implications for the study of genocide. It does entail, to a certain extent, stepping aside from or maybe even betraying some of our deepest instincts as historians, which is to consider specific events and specific data, the so-called thick description, which Geertz has talked so much about. And we are trained in that methodology, and this is how I've always approached the study of history and of the Holocaust in particular. But I think that what world history does is to invite us to view the subject of genocide as being a much more global, and not just global, but even world historical phenomenon, which affects not just individuals within a specific bounded space, but has international implications that are meaningful for vast regions of the globe. So I went onto the website for the World Historical Association, looked at their definitions of world history and their definitions and methodology. So I tried to think in terms of how these methods could be applied to the study of genocide so as to generate a genocidal analysis which was world historical in its basic thrust. And so I tried to reflect on that to a certain extent in 7 or 8 minutes at the end of our symposium. And I suggested that really there were two approaches which arise, the first being an approach to genocide as a phenomenon that transcends single states or cultures. And I suggested that Ben Kiernan in particular at Yale has advanced a very interesting social scientific model that seems to conform to this first prototype of a world historical approach to genocide. Of course, he tries to argue for a fourfold list of criteria, which he finds really characterized genocides going all the way back to Greco-Roman times and this siege of Carthage and tracing it forward to the present time. The second approach that I think is a world historically based approach to genocide would be more in the area of comparative history. And here I picked up on or kind of focused on Raphael Lemkin's original definition, which has been, I think, almost a recurrent leitmotif of the conference today. I think Lemkin's, I flitted from one panel to another today as the host, and I think Lemkin's name came up at every panel that I listened to. But his definition of genocide, which has generated quite a bit of discussion and even controversy, continues at the level of international law to generate all kinds of different appropriations of the term. We know that the Cambodians, in trying Khmer Rouge perpetrators in the Extraordinary Chambers, have taken that definition and really reformulated it in accordance with their understanding, their cultural understandings of genocide. We find similar sorts of tweakings. And Jonathan made reference to the trial by the Poles and the Supreme National Tribunal, the NTN, after World War II, of 7 very high-profile cases involving Höss and Greifeld and a few others. And likewise, the Poles adopted genocide and tweaked it in various ways to give it a very distinctive spin that was unique to their understanding of genocide. And this was 2 years before the convention was even adopted by the UN. So I see this as being an interesting way of thinking about genocide that has world historical implications, and it draws us away from just the single-minded focus upon events that are localized or are extremely particular, but compel us to think much more generally about this as a human process. One of the scholars who was on the roundtable, Chris Mariello, rightly pointed out that we have to be cautious because every event is inflected by the specific culture and nationality of the group and their cultural understandings of the event and specific history unique to that event. All of that is true. So really we are like trapeze artists balanced on that wire, poised between specificity on the one hand, but also a need to try to push our findings, hopefully in a more general direction, so that if we can identify certain signals or certain alarm bells for this phenomenon, we might at some point be able, theoretically, to intervene in order to prevent these events from happening, which would be the happiest and best of all worlds, I think.
So we have about 10 minutes left, and I thought we'd move towards some of the more broader themes here. And your last comment kind of hints at one. I heard a number of places across the day a concern about how you teach these matters and about the way in which you want to present Holocaust and genocide and massive violations of human rights in a way that is going to mean something important for the students. And so I'd like to open up, and I guess I'll just ask you, John, to start. What should our goal be in teaching these kind of things?
Well, that's not the easiest question, but I guess... I'll begin a class semester by saying something like, let's not be grandiose and say that we're all going to be more beautiful, uh-huh. be beautiful human beings and put an end to genocide. There was some of that kind of rhetoric around that attended the opening of the Holocaust Museum in the run-up to it. And then when it finally opened, if you simply walk in here, you'll become a better human being and so on. I guess we all have our different goals. I would say my goal is is just to try to induce people to think of themselves as a member of the human race instead of as a patriotic American or whatever they happen to be, and to reflect upon what it means to be a human. I also think it's important that we not have a sort of moral smugness where we say, I would have saved Jews, or I would have mm-hmm. fought the Nazis, or I would have saved Tutsi or whatever, because we really don't know. And that's an important lesson. That's something I learned from one of my mentors, Christopher Browning, mm-hmm. and his book, Ordinary Man, continues to exert a big influence, as it should, that we really are all capable of doing these mm-hmm. things. So I guess our goal is, if I have a classroom of 40 people, I would hope that every single one of them is going to learn something of lasting value. I know that half of them take it to fulfill a requirement. I know that maybe half of them take it out of a real genuine interest right from the get-go. But through the course of talking about these matters, by the end of the semester, everyone should have absorbed something. They might not remember exactly how many, exactly what happened in 1915 or exactly what happened or exactly who the three leaders of the Armenian Genocide was in the Ottoman Empire. But they've learned something at a deeper level about the human capacity for evil, but also about structures and about things like in a deeper way, about things like racism, about other forms of bigotry, and about their about the lethal potentials of these things.
Yeah. Mike?
I actually have a follow-up question, mm-hmm. and you'd make reference to Chris Browning, of course, mm-hmm. Another name that came up, I think, in every panel was his mm-hmm. book on Ordinary Men. But there's a section in his book where he talks about Stanley Milgram mm-hmm. and the famous or infamous, mm-hmm. depending on your standpoint, experiments that were conducted.
It's a very shocking experiment.
Yeah. Literally infamous.
The end of a long day of conference.
Yes, it's been a long, tiring day. I had the impression, I've read his book several times, and I do teach it from time to time. I had the impression each time I read it that Chris seems to be a devotee to a certain extent of Milgram's results. Of course, his results are that about two-thirds mm-hmm. comply with the command, and you always have more often than not, you'll have one-third more or less who will opt out or offer some resistance to the enticements of what Milgram called malevolent authority. Mm-hmm. Are you able to communicate that at all in your teaching to suggest to the students that more than likely, two-thirds of you would go along, and the one-third, more or less, probably would opt out. Does that ever come up in the context of your teaching?
Well, yeah, sometimes. Maybe not directly to have, like, two-thirds of them, but, like, volunteer to assume the guilt of the whole or something. But we also do talk in all my classes, whether it's a comparative genocide class or a full semester on the Holocaust, we talk a lot about racism in the 19th century, which really began before then, but the heyday of racism and imperialism, and then how that shapes modern genocide. So we talk a lot also, most students will be U.S. citizens. We talk a lot about stuff like that directly affects U.S. history. But just also on Milgram, there's a very good book that came out recently by a fellow named Eyal Press called Beautiful Souls. and the subtitle is something about people who, anyway, press starts in his intro, and he's a journalist, which means he's also a very nice writer compared sometimes, frankly, to we historians. But it really is a wonderful book, and he tells the stories of, he said when he read about Milgram, he wanted to know about that third, about that other third. Mm-hmm. And we don't think enough about the people who stand out and who do stand against the tide of conformism and peer pressure and everything else. So that's, at any rate, that's something else that's important in teaching, is even in genocide, not to falsely exaggerate resistance or defiance or nonconformity, but to include the full range of human responses in times of severe moral crisis.
John?
I have a slight different background from you guys because I've only taught all these years in the law school, different law schools. But as a result, I mean, it sort of answers a bunch of questions. The most recent, the Milgram issue is how do you convince people they'll be good or encourage good? Or law students look for something else. And I don't have to talk about, you know, Christian values of Western Europe versus Hobbesian views of life. I mean, I can basically say, look, the framers of this country, I mean, Madison and others in the Constitution, assumed that power can be very dangerous, that we set up structures which they intricately designed that will confine power, and that's the American way. And, you know, that doesn't explain, oh, yeah, well, what about slavery in the 19th century? Obviously doesn't account for all sorts of things, but it does say, don't assume that your idealism will mean that you would be the likely resistor. Assume that this country is framed on the idea that power can be very dangerous, and we make it hard for things to get done, which can be frustrating to many of us much of the time. Mm-hmm. More generally, though, about the point about the value of teaching, I mean, I have, you know, also because I teach in a law school, I have this very practical outcome, which is weirdly, unexpectedly enough, there will be students in my class who get jobs in this area. I have students who are both prosecutors and defense lawyers in The Hague. I have students who have worked for a variety of other NGOs around the world, you know, sometimes as short-term internships, sometimes as careers. So, you know, weirdly enough, it's what every dean wants to hear. I'm practical. I also, I guess, try and teach them, you know, in addition to, you know, obviously I share almost everything both of you have said about, you know, values and content, but I also, because it's law, I have to teach them and want to teach them tools. Mm. So how do you read the Genocide Convention? What cases, let's say, have there been that have narrowed this or questioned that? Or if you're in the next case, where would you look? And what might be a good argument if you're a defense lawyer in this genocide case? I mean, that's part of teaching legal skills, which I guess would only, you know, would apply more to me than you guys teaching history.
Yeah, Tommy, that your paper, at least, and your position suggests that you is directly focused on a kind of practical impact of your research. And I wonder what you would think about what you want people to know and get from your research, and to what degree studying genocide needs to have a practical result with a practical impact in today's world.
I'll kind of respond to these questions
please.
First as well. I'm coming as a student to genocide studies. I don't really have any background in it. Learning in high school and stuff about the Holocaust and stuff like that. And then there were some questions today about how everything was focused on kind of the 20th century and genocides and how we should be looking back. We should also be looking forward, too, and there's genocides that are happening right now on the rise. And I mean, like the ISIS and Syria stuff, nothing's really happening.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of, the newer technology and the new studies can kind of allow new ways to look at what's happening and maybe new ideas as to how to solve things and how to prevent these things from happening in the future. Like, you know, if you see things that are happening in Syria with the civil war, this is what's happened in the past, and maybe these triggers and satellite imagery or any kind of other indicators can allow people to kind of preemptively go in there and try to defuse the situation before it becomes a full-scale genocide or become, you know, before thousands of tens of thousands of refugees are fleeing from the countries.
Is it fair to say that, in a way, I mean, what you do, the Tommy, I'm sorry, what the satellite imagery does and other forms of intelligence, you know, in a way, is fascinating. It's really exciting for all of us in archaeology also. Mm-hmm. And for many of us, the temptation is to almost hope for too much, in the same way that criminal prosecutors and defense lawyers you know, 25 years ago with the advent of DNA evidence, kind of, well, sort out everything with DNA. Well, lots of times you can't.
Yeah,
and sure. That it's really tough often to convince juries that someone is still guilty, even, you know, when they go off in the room and think, well, there's no DNA evidence. He didn't do it. And there's this balance of, you know, there's a real audience looking for your answers. And we have to be careful not to put too much weight on it or ask too much of you as if it's the magic bullet for us to solve all our, is it?
Yeah, that's definitely true. It's just an interpretation of something. So it is kind of like a fingerprint. Or, I mean, I think there was a case a while ago where there was a person in Spain that was, they were arrested. Or they were in Oregon and they were arrested for the Spanish bombings in 2007, whenever it was, on the train because their fingerprint matched. And it just so happened that they had the same fingerprint as one of the bombers. Same thing with imagery. It's kind of, you could interpret it a different way, and it's not a, you know, 100% accurate scientific evidence. And just kind of using that to combine with other things would be a useful tool.
Has it been used yet in a legal case? I know it's been used, obviously, by foreign ministries and state departments and NGOs.
I know that it was presented in the Yugoslavian International Criminal Tribunal in 95. And I was actually showing some of the imagery from the Srebrenica and stuff over there as well. I'm not sure if it's been used as like solid evidence in any of the trials. I've heard or read some articles about how it can be introduced and how there needs to be more of a collection process and how to make it so it's more airtight.
A chain of custody.
Chain of custody things. But I'm not sure if that's been implemented yet.
Well, I know we could talk for a very long time about this, but I also know it's the end of a very long day for all of us. And so I want to say thank you so much for joining us today. I very much appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. And I hope that sometime in the future we'll have a chance to talk to each of you individually at greater length.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. You've been listening to a conference report from a conference titled Genocide in World History, held on the campus of Bryant University in Smithfield, Rhode Island. My panelists included John Cox, Tommy O'Connell, Jonathan Bush, and Mike Bryant. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I'll talk with Nicholas Stargardt about his new book, The German War, A Nation Under Arms, 1939 to 1945, Citizens and Soldiers. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.